Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
This is a week of questions, specifically questions about Equifax and the data of hours that they somehow let get into the wild.
So many questions. Obviously, there has been a ton of coverage of this as a news story, but we want to talk about some of the larger issues that you need to know about data, how to think about credit reporting agencies, data security, what tattered remains are left of our online privacy.
Not much, saved you a click. There's not much of online privacy left, but that's a whole different conversation. The Make Me Smart question this week goes to Ronald D. Moore. He runs the television show Outlander. If you're a fan of historical fiction and time travel, which I kind of am, except minus the bodice ripping part on that show, but that's a whole different thing.
What?
You mean
the good part? I mean, you can't even mention Outlander. I'm just going to shut that down right now. Before we get to the bodice ripping, we are going to get our Equifix. See what I did there?
I did. So look, Equifax. We've been talking a lot, actually. Before Equifax even happened, we were talking about a lot of the things that are involved with that particular breach of our privacy and our data, right? We've talked about privacy. Mm-hmm. We've talked about different kinds of regulations. We've talked about how if there were European regulations in effect here, this wouldn't have happened. And it's, you know, all about the value of our data and the security of our financial information, really.
Yeah. So the bare bones, in case you missed it, on September 7th, Equifax, which is, of course, one of the three giant consumer credit reporting agencies, announced that hackers had gained unauthorized access to data for 143 million customers, at least. The company says that breach initially took place sometime in mid-May or July. They discovered the breach on July 29th.
So we've been talking, each of us actually, Molly and me, to a lot of different people about why it happened, how it happened, what can be done about it. I talked the other day to Lily Hay Newman. She's a security reporter at Wired Magazine. And the gist of the conversation was, what did Equifax know and when did they know it?
You know, we really don't have a lot of technical details yet about what was going on all that time that the breach was happening. It's pretty typical for an attacker to kind of lie in wait or sort of have a reconnaissance period. They could have detected it sooner and started remediation sooner, and that would have been productive.
Yeah, one of the things Lily told me when I chatted with her from Marketplace the other day was this hack was basically the result of a software systems patch not installed back in March. And one of the many questions really is about disclosure. Why didn't the company have to tell us sooner than, hello, September?
So many questions. And in fact, going back to the software insecurity, it sounds like Cisco, which was responsible for that particular insecurity, did notify Equifax about that vulnerability. It is unclear. I mean, on the technical level, they couldn't have handled this more poorly. When it comes to that notification, I think the way that you phrased that question is key here. You said, why didn't they have to tell us? Mm-hmm. Because they don't have to.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's right. They climbed Everest because they can. The craziest part about, I think, what has happened in terms of our data protection here in the United States is that there are no federal overarching regulations that specify how data must be collected, how it should be stored, and how customers should be notified when their data has been stolen. And there are some state laws, but there's sort of no overarching regulatory framework that would protect us in this case. Now, I mean, I could go down that rabbit hole of rage in 2 seconds flat.
Yeah.
I would argue that it should be at minimum in place for somebody who deals with such sensitive information as a credit agency. But as it stands now, there is no overarching laws. Like I said, and Equifax is based in Georgia. And in Georgia, there's no timeline specified for when a company has to notify customers about a breach. What were they doing all that time? Probably figuring out just how bad it really was.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, oh, by the by, is not an excuse. I mean, I get that you don't want to come to market too early because, and when I say market, I mean the stock market, right? Because, you know, Equifax's share price is down like 34-ish, 35-ish% as of a couple of days ago since this hack was announced in September. So, you know, they're coming to the stock market and they're getting whacked by it. But still, I don't buy the fact that we don't have a right to know what has happened to our data and thus to protect ourselves, you know?
And one of the things that we when we did the oh-so-depressing data show
which really was, if you guys remember that, yeah.
It was really, it left, Kai was in a dark place for days, with Joel Reidenberg, which you may want to go back and listen to. One of the things we did talk about was the sort of attitude toward data in the U.S. versus Europe. And European laws, there are much more consumer friendly and much more strict laws around data privacy. And there is, in fact, as of May 2018, an EU-wide law is going to go into effect called the General Data Protection Regulation, which will deal with how personal data is treated within the EU and how it's exported. It makes it easier in some ways for like companies that in the US that do business in Europe to comply with the regulations. But if they don't protect data, the penalties are up to 4% of the worldwide profit of the company. So severe penalties. And a lot of experts are saying that this is the kind of thing, like, yes, if you're a company as big as Facebook or Google, it's possible you'll just invest in two separate compliance departments and you'll have different rules for the EU versus the US. But there is a possibility, A, that some of the protections of the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, could trickle down to US businesses, and that could be good for us. But for me, also, this right here, the fact that that exists should just be a framework for something that we put into place here. This should happen.
It's tough to disagree that we deserve more consumer protections when something like 143 million people's data is getting out. But, you know, we're not Europe, right? And we do things differently over here. And that's kind of the deal.
Well,
not to be, you know,
and Joe, you're fine with that?
Joe the downer. No, it's not that I'm fine with it. It's just reality, right?
No, I mean, I agree. In fact, we're on Marketplace Tech Wednesday, the 20th, which is maybe the day you're going to hear this. We're going to be talking with Nancy Kim, who's a professor of internet studies at California Western School of Law. And she, spoiler alert for the episode, she talks a lot about how when it comes to the consequences of identity, like on the one hand, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen now because this Equifax thing is so serious. But when it comes to the consequences of data breaches, you know, I'm quoting her when she says there's no blood. There's no dead body.
Wow.
Like it doesn't feel as dramatic to consumers in a way that gets them out in the streets calling their congresspeople because it trickles out. The consequences trickle out over time. The other thing she did say, though, and we talked to Joel Reidenberg about this somewhat too, is that we've kind of been boiled over time that the use and sale of our data not exactly advertised up front at the start of the digital era.
Even if people now know their data is being collected, they didn't necessarily know that from the beginning. If they had, if the first time you got an email account, or there was a possibility of that, they said, you know, we're going to scan all your personal emails and we're going to collect all that and, you know, we might do stuff with it later. You would have said, you know, I'm not going to use email. I'll just stick to snail mail. And you wouldn't be the only one. Everybody would have done that.
Yeah, you know, that's so totally true, right? Because this is terrible and naive and whatever, but I don't even blink anymore. I'm like, oh, yeah, data got leaked. I'm probably there. You know, I mean, I was a Target customer. I have Yahoo. I have OPM. I mean, all that stuff. My data is out there somewhere. And I know I'm tempting fate by saying this, knock on wood, but, you know, it's like, what can you possibly do? How do you survive? You can't let this keep you up at night because otherwise you have to disengage from the entire economy. On the other hand, there's my mom, right, who literally until 6 months ago would not get an email account because she didn't want to get hacked. Like email, just email,
right?
You know?
Well, and on the other hand, we have gone so far past. I mean, this is why I think something like the GDPR is so interesting. One of the things it includes is the right to be forgotten by a company. To say to a company, get my data out of your system. Why don't we have those rights? And part of the reason is because, using the boiling a frog analogy, the data octopus just grew and grew and grew. It would be one thing if even today in 2017 we were just talking about Google scanning your email and giving you ads.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is Google scanning your ads, your email, creating a database of information, selling that information to data brokers who then sell it to, you know, many other data brokers who use it to target ads across the internet. The level of data usage is beyond anything I think people realize or even could have imagined.
And here's part of why it's not happening. And I don't want to just throw the whole we're not Europe thing in there anymore. But we have and have had for hundreds of years, different philosophies of capitalism, right? And the philosophy of capitalism in the United States is and has been for decades now, if not centuries, that corporations have this ability to exercise rights and exercise muscles, if you will, in the economy above and over those of individuals. Whereas in Europe, for a long time, it's been the other way around, right? They come from a different kind of tradition, and that's why that's different. Let me ask you another thing, and I want to know if you talked to Nancy Kim about this. I have this theory that once all the information gets out there, right, it's going to lose its value because its scarcity is what gives it value. Does that hold water in your considered tech professional opinion?
I did ask Nancy that question because what I was starting to wonder is, are we just going to come up with different identity methods? Right. Are we going to start saying, you know, your social security number is useless as an identifier because we no longer use that for your login? So I did say, is there a point at which your data is so out there as a commodity that it loses value? And her answer made me just sent me off on a whole other million different intellectual tangents. Listen to it.
I don't think so. And the reason is there are, of course, the answer is always at some point, but not in the near future. I can see that viewpoint if you're just thinking about data in terms of showing ads. But that's old news. That's kindergarten stuff now.
Or even identity theft. I mean, would we ever get good enough at changing our biometrics or changing the identity markers that it isn't so valuable for identity theft?
I think that until we can feel confident saying that we've created a system that's not hackable, I think data is always going to be valuable and vulnerable.
All right. I'll go with that. I mean, she's the professional.
Okay. And also, here's the other thing she said about that. She said that the data at this point is so far beyond identity and targeting ads, and that the reason now that companies like Facebook and Google and many, many others are stockpiling data is to train artificial intelligence. And that it will always have tremendous value as a tool for creating artificial intelligence systems that can, you know, mimic our behaviors, predict our behaviors, and that is why data will always be, in the near term at least, incredibly valuable. And that, to me, I just wanted to do a whole episode on. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, because that seems, if not necessarily positive, then at least benign, right? It's toward the advancement of this thing. Listen to me. Of this thing we all know is coming, which is artificial intelligence. It's coming, right? And you want it to work.
This thing that
it is coming.
People like Elon Musk think is the worst thing that we could embark on because
it's going to kill us, right? Elon Musk says we need to get a little bit of machine learning inside our brain so that we can effectively counter artificial intelligence. But artificial intelligence is coming, and since it's coming, we want it to be good, as opposed to people who are going to use my social security number to steal thousands of dollars from my bank account or whatever the hell they're going to do.
Well, eventually they're going to use artificial intelligence for that too. But yes, I mean, all of these things have goods and ills, and artificial intelligence will unquestionably add great good to society. It will also add, you know, it will also make these the theft algorithms and the hacking tools and and all of that better and stronger and smarter. But I think certainly as a question of the value of data, that was a point that I had never considered
totally
before.
Agree.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Agree.
You'll hear much, maybe not tons more because the show's only 4 minutes long, but you'll hear more of my interview with Nancy Kim this week on Marketplace Tech.
We got a question on Twitter from at Steph the Blogger, which goes to an interview I did a month, maybe 6 weeks ago on Marketplace. And she wanted to know, how did it come to pass that companies like Equifax and Experian and all the rest of them get to rate our data, get to rate our credit, that is, in the first place? And the guy I talked to was a guy by the name of Josh Lauer. He wrote a book called Creditworthy. It's a history of consumer surveillance and financial identity in America. We've got the whole thing at marketplace.org, including the answer to Steph the Blogger's question. But I ended it with this question from me. What would happen in the economy today if we just didn't have credit bureaus?
It's actually unimaginable. So think about something simple, like you go to a big box store and you're checking out and the employee at the register says, hey, would you like to save 10% today by opening a store charge account? Well, all you have to do is provide a driver's license and a social security number. And in a couple of minutes, you can walk out of that store with hundreds or thousands of dollars of merchandise, all with the little promise that you might pay one day. And this is the
might pay. You know, that's a great line, right? Yeah.
That's the foundation of the modern credit economy. And for the most part, it works.
So for the most part, it works until, you know, they get hacked and then you're hosed. You know, but I mean, yeah,
why isn't there stronger protection around these credit agencies? You can't opt out, as many people pointed out, including us. You cannot opt out of this.
Right.
Of being a part of this system. You cannot, you know, there's no way to call Equifax and say you can barely get them to correct an error in the records that they have on you. And it is so not transparent. Like, I just find it astonishing that companies with this much power exist and have this little oversight, not to mention are this incompetent in terms of their own technology.
Have you met the American lobbying industry? I mean, that's the deal, right? That's why all the credit card companies are in South Dakota. That's why corporate America is all registered in the state of Delaware, right? Because lobbyists got to them. They set up safe havens, if you will. And that's that, he says, depressingly.
Do you think this ever changes in America? This point has come up a lot on our show, that this is how we do business, both mm-hmm. metaphorically and mm-hmm. literally in America. Mm-hmm. And what does that, like, I wish I had my moral capitalism political party theme song right now. Like, what are we going to be okay with this forever?
So
do you think, as American consumers? I'm just asking your opinion.
Yeah, no, I understand. And it's related to, I'm going to make an analogy here. As a way of ducking the question, because I don't know the answer. is the conversation around climate change going to change because of Harvey and Irma and the hurricanes this fall?
Mm. Right.
Magic 8-Ball says, no, it's not.
How much of that, too, is about our inability to process in our tiny little human brains the magnitude, right? Mm-hmm. The scale of the problem and the solutions required. Right. Because frankly, when it comes to untangling the U.S. economy and the various mm-hmm. forces and powers that press on it, it feels almost as daunting as trying to inhibit or reverse climate change.
It is, but look at it this way, and then we got to move on because we could go on this for one forever. Mm-hmm. But look, we had a generation-defining financial crisis in this economy 10 years ago, literally the worst thing in 70 years. And yet to this day, 10 years later, with the economy still stuck and bumping along the muddy bottom, with income inequality at highs we haven't seen in 100 years, with jobs in this economy not coming back as fast as we need them to, and economic growth stuck at 2%, no matter what the president of the United States says, right? All of those things have happened, and we are still having a discussion and a fight and a heated conversation over what we ought to do about financial regulation in this country. It is still happening.
Right. Right. And no one went to jail.
And no one went to jail. As my father would say, quod erat demonstrandum. Look it up. Mm-hmm. Also, I got an F in Latin first semester freshman year of college. It's true. It's totally true.
Is that you're just trying to stave off the emails?
That is absolutely correct.
That pronunciation was not great.
So anyway, let us know what you think. Write to us, makemesmart@marketplace.org or our website, makemesmart.org. Tweet at us. I'm at Kai Rizal. That would be Molly Wood, my partner in this broadcast.
Right here. I'm right over here.
At Molly Wood when she's on Twitter, which is like every now and then.
I'm trying. Did you see that Glenn Thrush is getting off Twitter?
I know. So interesting.
I know. I'm telling you, this is a thing. If you want to be part of our editorial meetings and also engage in the great evil that is Facebook, you don't have to have an account, but our editorial meetings are live on Mondays at 12 noon Pacific on our Facebook pages. Those are facebook.com/KaiRizdahl, facebook.com/Mollywood. We are working on streaming our video to other platforms. Some of those the difficulties involved may have derailed
may have.
Our Facebook Live video this week. But
coulda.
Keep an eye out because they're really fun when they happen.
Ronald D. Moore, straight ahead.
If you are wondering where you've heard this lovely song before, it is the Sky Boat Song.
I was, actually.
It's really pretty.
S-K-Y-E.
Yes, S-K-Y-E. It's a traditional Scottish folk song. I'm trying so hard not to brogue anything right now. A different version of that song is used as the theme song for the bodice-ripping TV show Outlander on the Starz channel. And this matters. This matters.
It does matter. And it matters because I had a conversation recently with the guy who's the showrunner for Outlander. His name is Ronald D. Moore. Ron Moore. The Ronald D. thing is like an IMDb thing. You got to differentiate yourself. Anyway, we've got the interview at marketplace.org. But I did ask him, since I had him in the studio, I asked him our Make Me Smart question, which is to remind everybody, what is something you thought you knew, but then you turned out you were wrong about it?
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
I guess the most obvious one is the recent election. You know, I thought I knew the country on some basic level. I thought I knew, you know, the way we react culturally. I thought I knew sort of what we're about when you got right down to it. And I was so wrong. You know, it was just a startling wake-up call that I do live in more of a bubble than I thought I did. And I thought, you know, and I'm a student of history, and I was a political science major, you know, and I love it. I consume news, you know, voraciously and read a lot. And I thought I just had a comfort level with, all right, well, look, I get a lot of this, and I get why some of this has happened, but we're not going to really do this. We're not really going to elect this man. This is not really possible. And I was one of those diehards that just refused to believe it all the way up through election night. I just could not go there. And that was an astounding wake-up call. It was just, wow, you were really, really wrong about this in every way. And it's really makes me sort of reevaluate, okay, I thought I knew the place I live. I thought it was a citizen of the larger United States. Well, maybe I'm more of a citizen of my particular piece of the United States. And I don't quite, even though I come from a very small town, it's very rock-ribbed Republican. And my parents are rock-ribbed Republican. And you go to the Central Valley of California, which is where I grew up. I mean, you drive up the 99. When I go home, there's all signs about Congress screwing around with the water supply and the UN black helicopters. So I grew up with all that. And I thought I got that. And I was at least in tune enough to understand that. But I still didn't believe that people I knew and grew up with were still going to vote for this guy. I just could not square that circle in my head. And I still can't. So I'd say that's the biggest sort of shock.
And it is 8 months later, and people are still coming to grips. Look, it was a cataclysmic change election. That's what it was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's that. That's that.
We have been asking you for the answers, your answers to the Make Me Smart question. We want more. We have gotten some. Please record your answer on your phone. You guys are getting so good at that. And if there is a refresher video on our website, marketplace.org. So many months ago, Kai and I had much fun making this video about how to record a voice memo.
More from y'all straight ahead, but got to pay the bills.
We got a lot of mail this week. Mail, tweets, all of it about our interview with April Rain.
Mm-hmm. And they were... I wanted to say questions, but they weren't really. They were questions. They were comments. They were challenges. They were generally, though, along two lines. One is, how can somebody protest? Well, maybe let's back up here. April Rain, the woman who came up with Oscar So White and also the No Confederate hashtag. And we talked for a while about both of those. The No Confederate hashtag being the thing that got started and trending after HBO announced that the guys who do Game of Thrones were going to do a new show in a couple of years, based on the idea that after the third American Civil War, slavery was still legal and the Confederacy had won, and it got, as you might imagine, very messy in social media very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Molly and I had some thoughts. We shared them, and you guys had some thoughts back, one of which was, how can you protest something that doesn't yet exist, this show, based on only a press release, which, fine. The other one was, how can we do an interview about the No Confederate hashtag when we're also reading Man in the High Castle, right? They're both alternate histories. What makes Man in the High Castle with the Nazis winning okay, but Confederate with slavery being legal not okay? And I guess my answer is this. Slavery, American history, the challenges we still have dealing with that in a deeply systemic way. And so that's my very short answer to a longer question. And it's short because when we talk about Man in the High Castle, I think, right, we're going to talk about this some more.
I think we are going to talk about it more, which makes it hard because we could definitely talk about it now. I mean, I will say I had not yet read. I will say by way of I guess, apology to the readers who had those questions, that we should have brought them up, like, in the interest mm-hmm.
totally,
of a,
totally
a long,
true. It, totally true.
So thank you, because you guys are absolutely right. And at that time, when I had not yet read The Man in the High Castle, but I had read a lot about what makes the two books different, I may have had a different answer. Now that I've read it and talked to various other people about it, I think they are equally, and maybe not equally, I think they are both really challenging topics. And I think we're going to have a lot longer conversation about this
yep.
when we talk about the book, because the book, I think, is, from what I can tell, very different from the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some of these issues are just as alive for the Jewish community as
yep.
they are
yep.
when it comes to Confederates. So I think it's a much more nuanced conversation than we had. And if our to true to the spirit of the Make Me Smart show, we should have had it.
You know, there's a case to be made. I'm just thinking out loud here, so don't nobody hold me to this. But I wonder if there's like a I don't want to get all touchy feeling kumbaya-ish on this here. But is there like a media ethicist that we ought to talk to? I don't know. Whatever.
I mean, look. I think one of the things that happened with Confederate is that it's a different political climate. Period.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an unbelievably ham-handed release
mm-hmm.
in the middle of a moment when I think many, many, many Black people in this country would argue that the systematic racism that is a part of our history is being re-systematized right before our very eyes. So you had a perfect storm of bad idea around what might have been a show that explored a topic in an okay way. We don't know. And
yep.
we probably aren't going to know. But I think it is fair to say, how can you protest something that doesn't exist based on a press release? It's just that, like, man, it was bad. It was bad. That was poorly done and poorly timed.
There is lots out there y'all can read. And we're going to put them actually up online at makemesmart.org or marketplace.org/makemesmart. And there's so much really thoughtful stuff, way beyond anything that came out of my mouth, for sure. On this, really, it's just hard, man. It's hard. Because life is hard.
It's hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard. And it's
yeah.
a tough time. And I get it. And it's scary. It's like, I feel like a little shaky. Like, it's scary to even talk about it because I know how emotional it is. But I want our show to do the best we can at trying to explore all of it reasonably. That's what we're here for.
You know, it's not hard, he says, in an incredibly awkward segue, but necessary, I think, to turn this conversation someplace else. What's not hard is going to Apple Podcasts and clicking on subscribe. How about that?
Yeah.
How about
yeah.
that?
Yeah. If you want to have this conversation with us, please do.
That's what you ought to do. Yeah.
Right? That's the whole point. So make me smart at marketplace.org. Tell your friends about the show. Read the book club book, The Man in the High Castle, because that conversation is real interesting. And I look forward to having it with you. Thanks for listening.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
You sounded like you weren't sure. Are you sure she's a senior
no,
vice
it was,
president?
No, it was like a drum roll moment. Bring it.
Is she a senior vice president or just a vice president?
D. Clark. I don't know. Did I screw up the title? Oh, my God.
Well,
no, I think she's a senior.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Don't want any title inflation around.
She's the boss lady.
She's the boss. She is the boss.
Like Lily saying boss. B-A-W-S-E.
Here we go. Boom.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.